Hello and welcome back to the Ice World podcast, the podcast from the British Antarctic Survey, where we talk to people currently living and working in one of the most extreme environments in the world. From climate scientists to carpenters, I want to find out what these people are doing at the Earth's frozen poles and what makes them tick. I'm your host, Nadia Frontier. I'm a marine biologist and I had the opportunity to live in Antarctica across two polar winters. I am really excited to bring you this episode, which marks the start of Series 5, an operations-themed series, and for the rest of the series, we'll be meeting people who make polar science happen. In today's episode, we're marking the 50th birthday of Rothera Research Station, the UK's largest research station out on the West Antarctic Peninsula. As well as being an important site for studying Antarctic changing climate and ocean, Rothera acts as an important hub for aircraft and deep field expeditions. To shimmer a historical perspective onto Rothera's 50th birthday, I first spoke to Elisa Fisher, who works at the archives at the British Antarctic Survey. She told me all about how Rothera was first established, and it's now the biggest of the UK's modern-day research stations. But the UK already had bases in Antarctica.
Yeah, that's right. So the British Antarctic Survey traces its origins back to Operation Tabarin, which was a secret World War II mission. So the aims of that were to deny the enemy safe harbour in Antarctica, to collect meteorological data to help Allied shipping across the South Atlantic, and also to stake a territorial claim. But even right from the beginning, science was part of what we did, and they even sent a lichenologist down at the time. At the end of the war, the Operation Tabarin became the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey, and we had that name until 1961, when we became British Antarctic Survey. The very first British station in Antarctica was Port Lockroy, also known as Base A, so that was founded during Operation Tabarin, and that closed in 1962. But actually, in the 1990s, it was taken over and managed as a heritage site, and it's currently looked after by a charity called the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust, who make it open to visitors. So some of our bases have kind of opened with a new life.
And people might have heard of that as the Penguin Post Office, as it is known today. And Elisa, what led to the decision behind establishing Rothera as a research station?
So there already was a base on Adelaide Island. So that was actually, the base is called Adelaide Island, also known as Base T. So that was founded in 1961 and was opened as a place for undertaking surveying, as well as geology and glaciology, meteorology. And it was also BASS's main air facility at the time, and a place where airborne geophysics work came from. They had a skiway there, so I don't know if people know what a skiway is, but it's basically a runway on ice or snow, so aircraft have to use skis rather than wheels to land and take off. But the skiway began to deteriorate, and so they needed to find another site to have a station on Adelaide Island. Rothera Point was originally surveyed back in 1957, so we were aware that there was quite a nice site there with a good harbour and potential for a skiway. And so they went back at the time in the early 70s to have a look and resurvey it in more depth to see if it was a good site. And then the decision was made to move operations there. So Rothera still remains BASS's main air facility today, and we're still conducting airborne geophysics from that location.
Wow, that is so interesting, and it is just so rooted in history. Being a meteorologist must be pretty special when you know that data has been collected there since the 70s. Wow.
Yeah, and it produces an amazing data set as well, that long-term data set that allows us to see the changes over time.
And could you walk us through the early construction of Rothera?
Yes, so the very first hut was built at Rothera in February 1976, and that just had a basic timber frame. Buildings built in Antarctica tend to be prefabricated, so there's like less work to do in the inhospitable environment. The building actually hosted the first wintering party, which was only four people, but in the following year, that's when construction began in earnest. And right from the beginning, it was going to be a phased process, spread out over some years. So that first building actually became the carpentry and electrical workshop. And in that first summer season, The first buildings were the main accommodation block, the powerhouse and a tractor shed. And then, as I say, it's just been a continued process of change. There's never really been that many years of stasis because, as you know, as technology changes, you need new facilities. As Rother has grown, there's needs to be more upgrades to existing buildings. So, for example, in those early years, there might have only been 30 people working over the summer season, whereas nowadays it's more than 150. So that's really, really big expansion. One of the main things that's happened at Rother over the years was a project in the early 90s, 91, 92 season, of building an airstrip, like a gravel airstrip, instead of just relying on the skiway. And also the building of a hangar. And that was really important because formerly the aircraft were lashed down up on the skiway. But there was a few instances where there was some major storms and the high winds actually flipped the aircraft over. And if you don't come back from that, I think those aircraft needed serious repairs or replacement after that. And we also built a wharf in 91-92 season. And this process of continual change continues to this day. So Rother is currently in the middle of a multi-year redevelopment project. So that began with building a bigger wharf to host our new research vessel, the RRS Sir David Attenborough. And we've also resurfaced the airstrip, put new lights in it. And this year, we're very excited because a brand new building is coming into service, which is the Discovery Building. So that's a big blue multi-use building that's currently just having the last finishing touches done to it at Rother.
And in the big living block that is known as New Bransfield House today, the corridors have lots of group photos of teams who have lived and worked at Rother over the years. It's kind of like school photos across time. But something that really initially jumps out to me is that they are all men, and there's also still dogs on station at the time in those early photos.
Yeah, so when Base T closed, 42 huskies, so that's four dog teams, were transported from Adelaide Island Station to Rother Station. And that's because dogs initially were really important in Antarctica, just logistically and operationally, because they were the means of transport. The dog teams would carry sledges loaded up with equipment to take people out into the field for surveying or science. But as technology improved and with increased mechanisation, skidoos and snowmobiles became more reliable, and there was a move away from using dogs and to using those forms of transport. But dogs weren't just there for their practical use. They also really improved life for people on station. When you're so far away from home for many years in a remote community, they really boosted morale and were a really important part of people's Antarctic experiences. And in the archives, we've got, you know, plenty of stories of people coming home and actually saying they missed the dogs more than they missed their colleagues. But in the early 90s, the environmental protocol to the Antarctic Treaty came into force, and that prohibited non-native species in Antarctica. I think they were worried about diseases spreading from the dogs to the wildlife. So the very last dogs on Antarctica actually left from Rother Research Station in 1994. As for the women, well, I'm very proud at working for British Antarctic Survey and what our organisation does and what we've achieved over the years. But one of the things I'm less proud of is that amongst all the Antarctic nations, we were one of the last to allow women to work south in a variety of roles. And unbelievably, I think the first women wintered in Rother in 1997, which is pretty shocking, I think. Although for about a decade before that, there were women beginning to come south and maybe doing some summer field work and that kind of thing. I think one of the other big differences between what life would have been like for people at Rother in the early days as opposed to now, I mean, you can't really see it in the pictures, but I think is communications and having contact back home. Maybe you'd hear about current affairs from the BBC World Service or something like that, but you wouldn't really be in touch with what's going on around the world. Whereas nowadays we have, you know, high-speed internet and maybe better connections than some people even have at home. So you've got that instant contact to your loved ones. Because, even 10 years ago, people had very expensive satellite phone calls home, and so you would only have a little phone call every week or something like that.
What you say about dogs, I remember whilst wintering, people would actually FaceTime their dogs because they missed their pets more than their families.
So. Oh, wow.
And Elisa, when you went to Rother, you went with such a strong historical perspective about Antarctica, how did you feel when you were actually there?
Well, it was amazing to like see the places with my own eyes that I'd read so much about and seen so many photographs of. But I think actually, because I went in 2022 and this Rothera redevelopment process was well underway by then, I had to wear high vis and hard hats when walking around station, and outside my window, I could see the steel framework of the Discovery building being erected. And so really the general impression of life there was that of like change and growth and looking to the future rather than looking to the past. But there are still those symbols of the history and the heritage and things that remind you of our past. So for example, the tents that are used at field sites are still the same design, these pyramid tents that have been used even back before Operation Tapper, and back in the golden age of Antarctic exploration, they were using pyramid tents, and we still use those today. People still talk about man food boxes, and that refers to the crates of rations that people use whilst working in the field. And they're called man food because that was to distinguish them from the dog food boxes, because you wouldn't want to mix up the human food and the dog food. And we also are using Nansen sledges. So those used to be pulled by the dogs, but now they're pulled by skidoos. But it's still this same design that people have been using in the polar regions for like a century or more. And I've had inquiries from current field guides working in Rothera back to the archives in Cambridge, asking to see the blueprints that we've got in our storeroom of the Nansen sledges, because they want to do repairs over winter. So we're still using that same technology. And also in the way we speak. So there's a vocabulary of words that people use in Antarctica that you don't use elsewhere. So for example, people talk about going on smoko, which is a naval term. You know, it used to be a smoking break, but these days it's just a kind of a tea break and also kind of an extra meal. And also scrub out is another term. Scrub out's when you help, you all get together and you help clean the station. And that's something that I see in the diaries and in the reports going back throughout the decades at all the different stations across British Antarctic Survey. So there is that connection to people that have been before us.
I think I'll never complain about the scrub out again then, because every time Friday rolls around, you're like, again, we've got to clean the station, but love the historical origins.
That's something that's quite unique to British stations as well, I think, and is a great leveller across all the different professions that work south. So it doesn't matter if you're the station leader or if you're a chef or the doctor, or everyone gets together and puts in the work and uses their elbow grease to clean the station.
Elisa, thank you so much for your historical perspective about women. And I'm so glad that we can welcome really strong women in positions of great responsibility today. It is so fascinating to hear Elisa's historical perspective on Rothera's past. And that will lead us on nicely to our interview with Aurelia. To tell us about Rothera past and present through their experiences, I'm joined by Rod Arnold, who is about to retire from his role as the head of the air unit. Rod first started his journey with the British Antarctic Survey as a biologist in 1989. I'm also joined by station leader Aurelia Highchard, who joined the British Antarctic Survey in 2017 as a marine biologist, and Matt Hughes, the current tower operations supervisor, who has maintained his role in the tower since 2021. You may recognise the familiar voices of Aurelia and Matt Hughes from previous seasons of the Ice World podcast, where Matt co-hosted some episodes with me in season 4, and Aurelia featured in the first season 1, episode 6, when Rob Taylor used to host Ice World. And Aurelia also more recently joined us in an interview with Paul Whitelaw about Antarctic seabirds. Matt, you oversee a lot of the logistics of people coming and going from Rothera. Can you paint a picture of what that's like?
Yeah, it's different at different times of year, and it's really exciting for me at the beginning of the season when we arrive at Rothera in mid to late October, where we get the first Bass Twin Otters coming in, the first Dash 7 flight, which I'm usually on, and then we get all of these transiting aircraft from the other national programmes, and Rothera's in this beautiful snowy landscape. It's still lots of snow at that time. The team have been busy snow clearing the runway to make sure it's safe for the aircraft to come in. And we've got this very vibrant, busy couple of weeks where everyone's slowly arriving on different dash rotations. We've got the transiting crews going on to the South Pole. And then we transition into our field operations side of flying, where we're opening up all of our field stations, getting our science teams out doing the science before we reverse everything at the end of season and we get all those aircraft coming back through and heading back north, back through South America and up to Canada, where they usually end up.
Well, that is some serious logistics to coordinate as tower supervisor. We've actually got a little bit of audio of you working in the tower, which we can have a listen to now.
Sky Blue, Rotherham. Hi, Joe. That is a good copy from Bravo Lima. For your information, they are routing direct to you at this time. I don't yet have an estimate for Sky Blue, but I suspect it will be approximately 16:30 Zulu. I'll update that once she's past her first position point.
OK, yeah. BL is heading direct to us, a very approximate estimate.
Oh, I just love the sound of the tower. It reminds me when I used to go up the tower stairs and ask Matt for permission to run on the runway. How did you get this role?
Well, I started my career in aviation as an air traffic controller. I was working at Exeter Airport down in the southwest, and I worked as a tower and radar controller. It was a job I really enjoyed, but I was kind of getting a little bit disillusioned with working in an industry with just lots of people going on holiday, especially from the airport I worked at there. And I wanted to be part of something where I felt like I felt a bit better about what I was doing. And then this job with BAS came up, and I thought, that's the job. And I was very lucky to get the job first as a radio operator and then progressing on to be the tower supervisor.
So it's your fourth season now. Do you feel complete? Do you feel that change was worth it? Are you satisfied with everything you're doing?
Yeah, I definitely get much more of what I'm doing. I'm really excited to see all the science that we're doing and to, we'll talk a lot, I'm sure, about community, but there's much more of a community aspect to it. In my old job, I was just up in the tower, not really interacting with other people on the airfield that much. Whereas at Rothera, I get to interact with everybody all the time. I have very close relationships with the BAS pilots, but also our Canadian counterparts from the transiting crews. I get to speak to the scientists, learn about the science that they're doing, and I get a sense of much more involvement and much more pride in what we're doing.
And Matt, part of the new Discovery building, there is a new operations tower. What is the view like from your window when you're looking through your little glass pane of the tower?
Well, I would say it's the best view on station. 360 degrees all the way around the peninsula. We're a little bit higher than the old ops tower and a little bit further to the north. And so we can see a little bit further to the northeast. You can see the mountains just coming out from the other side of the point. We've got the big ramp in front of us leading up to Reptile Ridge and the rest of the peninsula and Adelaide Island out to the south with all the sea. We get to see the humpback whales. We're usually the first people to see a lot of the wildlife that's going on. And then importantly, a perfect view of the runway so we can see what all the aeroplanes are doing and keep an eye on them.
I mean, I think that trumps anyone officer's window for sure. Rod, if you were to go back to Rothera 25 years ago, at about the time when you first went there, could you describe to us the landscape that you would have walked across?
So the cobbles in the backyard were, you know, big round cobbles because it's a raised beach. Much of Rothera is a raised beach. So you've yeah, you've got sort of pebbles like you'd see at some of the big beaches in UK, and they're grey. They're really just a light grey when they're dry. They're really dark grey and different colours when they're wet, but if it's a dry day, then they're a lightish grey, and they're difficult to walk on. They're an awkward-sized pebble, I would describe them as. So I guess what did Rothera look like? I think with the Discovery building now, it'll be a compact and tight station. It was an organic station with, you know, the corridor that led to the old Jenny shed and stuff. It developed organically, and you could see that it wasn't particularly well planned. You know, you'd have a generator shed that's right off on one side, and green buildings would be my description, green corrugated sheeted buildings, functional, square functional buildings, not particularly pretty, but then, you know, didn't particularly expect pretty buildings. I just wanted functional buildings. And then yeah, you've got a couple of structures, which are the sort of steel galvanised miracle spans is what they're called. So the boat shed and the miracle span where the vehicles were kept in the main area. And I guess it was very focused around the centre of the station. And it then over time, you sort of, we got the Admiral's building for accommodation, which was quite low compared to most of the other buildings in its sort of aspects of a single story, and quite long with, I think it's 44 rooms in it. You know, it just gradually grew. Whereas I think now we've got this idea of how we want the station to work efficiently. It was what it was, you know, it's what you arrived at. And I would describe Rotherhithe, it depends whether you arrive start of season and it's all covered in snow and looks really nice. And then in the middle of the season, you've got these grey rocks, which is a bit like a quarry. And then it, you know, you go back into, you know, February and you start to get the snow covering again. And there's a few more seals pitch up in, you know, towards the end of season, fur seals and things like that.
Aurelia, what does the job of a station leader mean to you? How did you get into it?
So I first started with Bass in 2017. In September, like most other people who go down to the deployed stations by joining in something we call PDT, so pre-deployment training, where everyone comes together and everyone's kind of new and doesn't really know what they're getting into and being really overwhelmed. And I was a bit like, how did I get chosen for this? I don't think I'm at the right place. I don't think I can do this. So there was quite a lot of overwhelm to get over. And then I went down to Rotherhithe and worked in the Bonner Laboratory as a scientist for a while, which was really fulfilling and really, really interesting. But I went on a bit of a journey to get away from academia, which is all I'd sort of focused on previously, and went into this new world of operations. And then I ended up in this job that I am right now, which is the station leader at Rotherhithe. So this role to me is a very fulfilling role. It's very challenging at times. There's so much diversity to it. It's absolutely incredible. You never really know what your day-to-day is going to look like because Rotherhithe is such a complex and big operation. We do so many different things. We've got the aircraft and we've got field stuff going on. We've got obviously our entire science programs. We've got atmospheric science, marine science, and as a station leader, you're sort of in theory managing and overseeing everything happening in a safe, balanced, conjunction, supportive way. Yeah, it's incredibly satisfying and challenging and really, really interesting. And most and foremost, it's all about managing people and people's interactions.
And in the height of summer, what's the maximum people you are responsible for and looking after?
Rotherhithe's got a capacity of up to 168 people. Now, we don't always want to fill that because should anything go wrong in the field, we always want to have the capacity to bring people home and look after them. So we reserve a few beds for those kinds of reasons or for transiting aircraft who might come through with urgency. So we tend to be somewhere around 155, 160 people in the peak season. Obviously, in the winter, that is a lot lower. So we go down to the mid-20s, 30s. This winter, we've got a lot more people because we are completing the Discovery Building project. So we've got a few construction staff overwintering as well, and a few more estate staff to kind of bed in the building and make sure we take it over in the right way and we keep the people on station safe with this new massive asset. Yeah, it's like a small village.
Rod, there must be a huge difference between your initial arrival to Antarctica, your first experience being at Cygni Island, and your experience of Antarctica now.
Back then it was all in contracts. It was equivalent to the AP. So you were on a contract for 3 years. I was a single winter. Other people would be two winters. But it was still a sort of 36-month contract initially. And then I was fortunate enough to bid for another contract in terrestrial and freshwater life sciences, as it was then, the biology section. So initially, it was with Dave Wynne-Williams on soils at Cygni. Anyway, I was working with all these massively high-flying young scientists, and I felt there's that imposter syndrome. I felt I wasn't quite cutting it. So, yeah, so I looked at changing career. Worked in the stores. Worked in the clothing store. I'd done quite a lot of outdoor stuff because I've been South Georgia. I was fairly familiar with all the field kit. So I serviced all the field equipment in stores. Role came up doing the field operations manager's job. And that was superb. That was a great sort of, 9 years. Really fantastic working. You know, Alan Meredith, chief pilot, came in and made the operation much safer. You know, all the pilots you worked with, there's a real team effort, absolutely brilliant. All the pilots I worked with were fantastically supportive. That led into sort of a permanent role in the air unit. And then Jerry Nicholson retired from being head of the air unit, and I applied for the role and got it. So, yeah, and that was 2013. It's a really strong team in the air unit. It, you know, leaving creates opportunities for other people. That enthusiasm, that fire to change, you know, you need to have that. And you need to leave. I think you need to leave while you're still hungry.
So going back to science, Aurelia, what kind of science does happen at Rothera? Can you give a bit of a broad overview of the scope and Rothera's role in BAS science policy?
So Rothera has multiple roles. One which I will talk about first is the role as a logistics hub and as a sort of onward platform for science. So that's where Matt comes in, that's where the planes come in, that's where all the staff around the air unit come in. They're all there to ensure that scientists who come to Rothera who want to work in the field can get transported onwards and their science kit gets deployed with them. So Rothera is an incredibly important hub for that. Due to our air operations being stationed there, we can then go forth into the field and deploy science. So that could be any kind of science. A lot of it is around glaciology, ice core drilling, understanding the climate, understanding the past climate to predict future climate, understanding potential for sea level rise, deglaciation, kind of big climate questions that are really important at this time in Earth's history. Closer to home, we are also a science station where we have our own science projects and experiments and long-term data series based. That we've got a variety of scientific disciplines that we cover there. So we do atmospheric science projects. We've got instruments deployed all around Rothera that look up into the sky and look at various aspects around atmospheric science. We've got a hut that measures particles in the air to understand cloud formation and the importance of the Southern Ocean in cloud modelling, in global cloud modelling, which is relatively badly understood, and we don't really know yet how the Southern Ocean features into kind of the worldwide cloud cover, what impact that has in models and how we can better capture that. So that's something that we do, which is also connected with airborne science. So we've got a hut on the ground, but we also deploy sensors on planes and fly around and understand clouds better. So that's an ongoing project, which is big. We also do a lot of marine science. So we've got a boating program, we've got a diving program, and we attempt to dive through the sea ice of present. We dive as long as the water is open, we go for it. There is a long-term monitoring that goes on, biological long-term monitoring, oceanographic long-term monitoring, water sampling, anything to understand water masses, the kind of the entire ecosystem in the Southern Ocean, near shore. Benthic biology, so what happens on the sea floor, how is that impacted by deglaciation, how is this impacted by climate change, how is it impacted by the shifts in the sea ice and therefore shifts in productivity, and what does all of that do? How does that entire ecosystem look like? We also do some long-term monitoring on our local bird populations. We try to correlate that with the shift in things that we observe in the marine realm to understand how these seabirds are being impacted as an indicator species. And then if you go even further up into the sky, back into the atmosphere, we do weather observations, which feed into global weather models, but also are really important for our planes. So it's quite holistic. There's a lot of different things going on. Rothera is produces a lot of science, but is also in and on itself just a great hub for people to come and do their science. So we've got a fantastic laboratory, the Bonner Laboratory, which has got a diverse range of labs that can be used for all sorts of different things. And with the arrival of drones as well, there's an even bigger world that is opening up. So yeah, it's a fantastic place to do science.
That is such an excellent and amazing succinct summary. Thank you very much, Aurelia. And while Rothera is very well equipped and conducting so much research, it is a really extreme environment, and all three of you do have to take on such a big responsibility. Matt, what's it like supervising a team and being responsible for their welfare, but then also being responsible for aircraft journeys in order for them to fulfil their science objectives in the field?
So in my team, we're usually a team of five. So I've got some radio operators, And they've usually got a really good aviation background, so they've got experience in dealing with some aspects of aviation operations before. Some have been pilots, some have been air traffic controllers, and some have worked in similar and different areas of the aviation industry. So I already get a really good qualified team of people that come in, and then it's adapting them to the Antarctic environment, because we do things quite differently. They use their experience previously as well to make sure we see all of that through safely. And then I've got that responsibility as well as a line manager to keep check on the welfare of my team as well. Line managing has been something new for me over the last couple of years, so I've been learning a lot. Aurelia has been a really great sounding board for me and has helped me out with a lot. And it can be tough. Sometimes we've got very long days of flying. We start flying early in the morning, and depending on what's going on, we could end up finishing really late in the evening, and just making sure that people are well rested and getting some downtime, which can be tough at times. But yeah, it's been quite a responsibility, but it's one I've certainly been enjoying.
You've got to keep it in perspective and remember that you're working with a really, really good team on the ground, but you're also working with an outstanding team back in Cambridge who are only a phone call away and who are there to support you, and a lot of whom have either done this job before or who have experience working in Antarctica. Even beyond that, you've got the entire community of the Antarctic research community. So we've got other stations that we've worked with, not just BAS stations, but other national programs that we work with and transcend these national boundaries that might exist elsewhere and sort of be this Antarctic community. So that then makes your responsibility seem a little bit smaller, and you realize you're kind of part of this community as a whole. You can find solutions to these problems that logistics and the environment pose upon you.
You do get something from that osmosis of working with the you know, people are excited about their role, and that has an effect on you. It doesn't matter whether that's working with a scientist or, you know, somebody who's excited about, you know, a new project they're delivering, but that's infectious, and that really helps. And that's what keeps people at BAS. You know, you see Matt, you see Aurelia, you know, come out of the science realm, and they're hungry to do good stuff for Rothera, good stuff for the people who they're working with. And that just builds, and that's essential. You can't just be good at your job. I think you do get that osmosis and that excitement, which builds a community, and it is a community.
Aurelia, as a station leader, what perspective and insight could you give about the current station morale and activities that are organised to keep everyone sane, I guess, in such a remote and isolated village, as you termed it?
It's an ongoing challenge. A lot of people initially come to Antarctica and are, as you would be, fascinated and completely fulfilled by what is before their eyes, you know, the glacier, the sea, the icebergs, the wildlife. You know, that lifts morale, that gets you very excited. So you initially arrive, it's all quite wonderful. But then the reality hits that, you know, it can be quite a hard job to do. And you do end up getting into a routine of where it's week in and out, you do certain tasks, and that initial shine potentially wears off. The community of the people on station are the thing that drives people to come back year after year, because they found something that either they can't find back in where they come from. And, you know, we intrinsically want connection with other people. I make it very clear to everyone, there is no entertainment manager on station, and there is a plethora of things to do. You know, there are sporting activities that you can do, a running scene. Now that it's winter, the hangar can be used for things like badminton. But we also have quite a vivid indoor activity scene. You know, people get together to do board gaming. People have become quite creative in organising events. People can get really creative.
Rod, are there any particular memories you have from maybe 1989?
That's too long ago. I was just very excited to be able to winter in the Antarctic, and the guys, it was an all-male wintering station at the time, the guys I was with from massively different backgrounds. Several of the guys had wintered before, the diving officer had wintered before, we had the opportunity to dive, you know, all that sort of stuff. So everybody had their specialty, but everybody was willing to pull together to make it all work. So I was really lucky. I really enjoyed my winter. Yeah, I don't think I could have had a better introduction to BAS. It was exciting, challenging, but I felt supported enough. And obviously back in that period, you had 125 words a month to two contacts. So the comms were very, very different. But you got the support from the team around you. With the better comms, you'll get support from a wider team. So whether that's as a scientist, you're able to get your supervisor's intervention more frequently, not just a fax message of a paragraph. And, you know, personally, I think it opens up the opportunity to winter and that sort of stuff to a much wider group of people than those slightly odd individuals who are willing to section themselves from the rest of the society for 18 months. So no, I think that's really healthy. I think it's a really great change. People always look back and think, oh, it must have been better back in the day. I would challenge that. I think you make of it what you get at that period. Yes, looking back, it always looks a bit better, but that's just how it is. I don't think it was. I think the challenges are just different.
And Matt, how do you see the next 50 years at Rotherham?
When I think to what aviation capability we're going to have going forward, we've got our twin otters that are just workhorses. They're going to be going for another lifetime or so yet. But we've started, as we've mentioned, started using more drones and remotely piloted systems. We used a big fixed wing drone a few seasons ago called Windracers. And it's interesting looking at the future of what that type of platform can enable us to do. And I know the Antarctic community are looking at using more of these bigger drones on a much larger scale to work with crewed airborne assets like the Twin Otter. And seeing the capability of what Windracers could do in terms of the photography they could do, but the information they could get out of that with various different cameras, different lasers, and different means of obtaining information was really interesting. And it's a capability that we've not been able to do. We're going to be able to go to lots of new places and do remote science from an aerial platform that we were never able to do before. And I look forward to being involved with that.
And Aurelia?
The modernisation at Rotherham, I think, is really important and across BAS to allow us to keep up with this pace. You know, we need to keep pushing forward because there are so many more challenges that BAS needs to tackle and that the Antarctic community needs to look at. There's got to be a balance between this commitment that is being made to a sustainable operation and to the net zero goal and shipping people down to the Antarctic. Obviously, there's a lot of value in having people there on the ground making decisions, but going forward, it has to be something that we constantly consider and that the programme team will consider and that our net zero team will be pushing and that will just have to be a big part of BAS's journey in the future. What is a community going to look like at Rotherham 50 years? Will it look more kind of even more connected? You know, maybe there is an even more connected network of the people that work in the Antarctic who can collaborate on big questions, and maybe we'll have even more multinational and massive science projects that we conduct. That's what I'm hoping for. I hope we're not going towards a community where we are living in a virtual bubble and people are going to the Antarctic, but mostly just living through their phones and media. I hope that what we all come down for, what Rod was talking about, what Matt was talking about, this feel of the community, the people connection, I really hope that will always stay part of the Antarctic experience.
And following on from that, Rod, if you could take one object or one slice of memory and put it in a time capsule for a future member, what would it be?
I guess for me, it would be some of the opportunities to do the flying. So some of the co-pilots I've been fortunate enough to be on, and even this season, being out in the boats in the back of Ryder Bay and there being groups of whales that I'd never seen before because I hadn't been down very recently in that end of season when the whales have recovered back to pre-whaling levels, certainly in the southern humpback populations. And there were just whales everywhere in the back of the bay against the glaciers. Even right up to my last trip, I was seeing stuff that would create memories for me. It wasn't reflecting on the past. It was the being there in the here and now. Yeah, I've been really lucky. I don't think there's any single thing that I'd single out. There's been stuff every single time I've gone, which you lock away.
Would you, either of you two like to answer the time capsule question?
I think it was in my second or third season. I went up to the caboose a few kilometres away from station one evening. You can get away from station. And there was not a cloud in the sky. And it was absolutely silent. There was no wind at all. And I've never experienced total absolute silence before. And I think I've always thought it would be quite a scary thing, but it was just beautiful. I mean, the sun was kind of just getting to the bottom of its traverse through the sky, and we just sat there in silence for a while, just soaking up this really surreal moment of, I don't think I've really got any words to properly describe it, but it was a really emotional moment for me that I think I'll always remember.
If I had one that I could pick and just carry with me in a little tiny, like a keychain thing, I think it might be from when I was wintering and I was working in the Bonner Laboratory, which is at the southern end of the station. And to then walk home, you have to go north to our accommodation building. Reptile Ridge is off to your left. And at that part of the season, the sun sets very, very early or doesn't rise yet, so you get to see the stars. And one of the things that is etched forever into my mind is the outline of Reptile Ridge with an ever so slight glow of the setting sun or the rising sun, you don't really know, behind it, and the Sirius star just visible above it, and then ever so slowly the other stars coming into view. And then if you couple that with that just right crunch of snow under your boot, and the kind of cold air in your nostrils that just freezes your nostril hair ever so slightly. I don't actually know if that moment existed as such, but that combination, I think, for me, is my little time capsule moment.
And such a beautiful ending to this episode. Thank you so much to my three guests for joining, and it's been great to hear from you. Having lived and worked there, you really do feel that you're part of a community, and you don't always realise it, but it gives you such a strong sense of identity. And there's something really special about leaving station for fieldwork and then coming back to the dining room in the evening with a panorama of mountains and glaciers, and know that you can actually call this place your home. And if you would like to help contribute to making polar science happen, then do check out the many roles available in the jobs section of the British Antarctic Survey's website. And if you enjoyed the Ice World podcast, please do tell people and think about writing a nice review. It really does help us spread the word. In our next episode, we will hear from three guests during their darkest month of the year, wintering at the only three British stations that operate all year round. I'm Nadia Frontier, and thank you for listening.